Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
This was a day when you could well ask, wait a minute, is this the best we can do? More evidence of how fundamentally the American economy has changed the past 2 years. Also, your letters and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates go looking for a handout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, protecting online privacy by monitoring the web and removing your personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and Progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 28th of September today. The Census Bureau did one of its regular data dumps this morning. Since the recession started 2 years ago, fewer people have been getting married. More people have been moving in with friends or relatives. Food stamps use is up, and the wealth gap is wider than ever. So, too, is the gender gap. The Government Accountability Office says that while women make up nearly half the American workforce, they hold only 40% of management-level jobs, with some notable exceptions, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Construction and public administration. They're the two industries where the federal government says the percentage of women managers is higher than the percentage of women employees. If you're paying attention, you're probably thinking, did she really just say construction? Sure did. But I'm not saying women are dominating the construction industry. There's just a higher percentage of women toting number one boss mugs around construction sites than women lugging tool chests, because so few women are employed in the industry overall.
Starting from a very low base, it's not surprising there are actually more women being managers.
Marianne Bertrand is an economist at Chicago's Booth School of Business. The other field where women are more than proportionally represented in the boss's chair is public administration, government work. It's also one of the industries where men and women get paid most evenly. Andrew Sherrill is with the Government Accountability Office.
In federal and government positions, there is often more transparency in terms of salaries for different positions.
That helps even the score. Julie Kaufman is with the consulting firm Bain. She says at the government level,
there has been a real push on diversity and on trying to make sure there are opportunities for advancement for women and for other less represented groups.
That helps, too. Still, female managers in public administration get paid only about 87 cents for every dollar their male counterparts make. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
2 years ago, the financial crisis brought us the biggest bank failure we'd ever seen, Washington Mutual going broke and being bought by J.P. Morgan for less than $2 billion. Now it seems J.P. Morgan Chase is getting ready to ask the FDIC for its money back. Three times its money back, actually. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
J.P. Morgan Chase wants the FDIC to pay billions of dollars in claims from lawsuits related to Washington Mutual's failure. The deal J.P. Morgan signed when it took over the dying bank could hold the FDIC responsible for those liabilities. It's not clear whether the FDIC will have to absorb those losses. William Isaac was chair of the FDIC in the 1980s. He says the agency usually has a pretty good idea of how much a failure will cost.
They look at the assets and they try to figure out what they're worth and what kind of recovery they're going to get on those assets, how long it's going to take, and they also make estimates of how good legal claims might be.
So he thinks it's unlikely all the bank failures will end up costing much more than the FDIC has estimated. And he thinks the pace of failures will slow down as long as the economy doesn't go into a double dip. Karen Petru is a banking analyst. She thinks given the number of banks on the watch list, more failures are inevitable, as are more lawsuits demanding money from the FDIC.
There are always lawyers. There's always going to be litigation. but I don't see any of it as game changers in terms of the FDIC's cost of recovery or redefining the taxpayer risk for the banking crisis.
In any case, J.P. Morgan has made out pretty well in spite of the lawsuits. Among other things, it said interest on Washington Mutual loans could bring in as much as $25 billion, and it got a network of bank branches across the country. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
It used to be enough that food just tasted good. Now it's got to stop you from aging, keep you from getting fat, and help you stave off cancer in the bargain. Or at least that's what marketers would have us believe. And believe we do. Grocery store shelves are full of healthy this and antioxidant that. But the Federal Trade Commission and the Food and Drug Administration have been cracking down on those health claims. The latest is Palm Wonderful, the pomegranate juice that comes in those funny-looking bottles. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
Palm is known for cheeky ads, like one that shows its juice bottle with a noose around its neck. The tagline, cheat death. The Federal Trade Commission says Palm is the one that's cheating. It says the company's claims that its juice helps prevent prostate cancer, heart disease, and other problems amount to false advertising.
We all want to, you know, buy the brand that has the most bang for its buck, and we're going to buy the one that we think is loaded with the most, you know, health-oriented things.
Carrie LaFerle teaches advertising at Southern Methodist University. She says consumers could turn on Palm.
People don't want to be lied to. And so I think when they find out if they have been lied to, it won't go well for the brand.
Palm pretty much owns the pomegranate juice market in the U.S. The company's sales were about $91 million last year. Palm sued the FTC earlier this month, anticipating the crackdown on its ads. A statement on its website says the company aims to communicate, quote, the promising science relating to pomegranates. Promising science that the company paid for. Bruce Silverglade at the Center for Science and the Public Interest says Palm studies are lacking.
You must have a large enough sample. You need to have a control group to compare your results to. Palm didn't do that.
But Silverglade says Palm isn't likely to bow down.
I think it's cheaper for them to fight this suit than to give up the claims that have duped millions of consumers into paying hundreds of millions of dollars for their product.
If the FTC wins, Palm could have to pay millions in damages to those consumers. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
Traders really didn't know what to do today. Down, up, you name it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you really want to get rich in the markets, one way to do that is to put your money in a private equity fund. Of course, there's a catch. You usually have to have a pretty sizable bankroll to start with before those funds will even let you in the door. South Carolina State Pension Fund does have a couple of $1 billion to play with, but they are going to do something a little bit different. They're going to start their own private equity fund to see if they can't beat the markets themselves. Peter Latman wrote about the story in the New York Times today. Peter, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Why does South Carolina feel the need to do this?
Well, it's interesting and a bit surprising that this has come from South Carolina, which you don't normally think of as sort of pioneering in the arcane world of pension fund management. Typically, you think of, you know, CalPERS, the big California mm-hmm. pension fund, or even, you know, Texas Teachers. But South Carolina has made a decision that's somewhat outside of the box here to set up their own investment firm and to take money management into their own hands rather than, you know, handing it to other firms to manage.
Do they think they can do it better, or are they just looking to save money? Because, as we know, private equity firms, they take a lot off the top before you get your profit back.
Right. Well, the first idea is to save money. So the fees that these private equity funds charge are, some might say, rapacious. And I think the pension funds over the years have been scratching their heads saying, you know, is it really worth it to pay all these fees when, you know, after all, the returns over the past decade haven't been great? So this CIO, the chief investment officer down there, I think he's a, you know, he's an intelligent guy and he's an ambitious guy. And I think he's saying to himself, well, if we can set up our own fund and hire our own people, you know, not only can we save fees, but perhaps we can also perform as well as some of these firms that we've been having manage our money.
They're putting $5 billion into this, which is in absolute terms a lot of money. But in the world of private equity, it's peanuts.
That's right. That's right. So, look, this isn't going to really make huge waves in the private equity world. But if, you know, this is looked at as an innovative approach, you know, something out of the box, and if you start to have some of the bigger pension funds like CalPERS or the New York Pension Fund, which is, you know, a $125 billion portfolio, if they look at this move and say, hey, this isn't a bad idea, let's try it ourselves, you know, then you're really going to start to see a ripple effect, and that could have an effect on the private equity industry.
As we know, there are some people on Wall Street who used to do a lot of banking for a living. They're now looking for jobs. Is South Carolina a place that they're going to say, ooh, I want to go and work down there?
Well, someone said to me yesterday, well, if I could live on Kiwa Island and play golf all day and, you know, making it to Charleston once a week, I'll go right down there. But, you know, that's one of the big challenges is going to be competing for talent. Because the idea is to charge less fees here in setting up this firm, you know, they're probably not going to be able to compete with the Blackstones and the Carlyles and the KKRs for talent. So, you know, while there is, you know, a decent job market out there in terms of people who are hiring, there's a lot of people looking for work, you know, it's not clear that the idea of working for the South Carolina Pension Fund in Charleston or, you know, even in New York is going to compare to a big fancy Wall Street job.
So here's the payoff question. Are they going to be able to beat the returns that they've been getting? Are they smart enough to do that?
I'm skeptical. So, look, there are some models outside the United States where it has worked. But, you know, look, these guys are expensive, the KKRs and Blackstones, yeah. But they're also pretty good at what they do. So I think it's going to be all in the execution, and I think the jury's still out on whether these guys can perform as well as the, you know, outside managers they've been dealing with.
Peter Lattman from the New York Times writing in the paper this morning about South Carolina starting its own private equity fund. Peter, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Guy.
Even at 2,000 whatever it is pages long, the healthcare reform law that was passed this past summer left a whole lot out. Details big and small are up to federal agencies to take care of. Eventually, everything's going to fall to the Department of Health and Human Services. They're going to have to actually write the rules of healthcare reform. One of the big ones, a rule of keen interest to both insurance companies and their customers, is something called the medical loss ratio. It obliges insurance companies to show that they're spending a certain amount of the premiums they get on actual care instead of administrative costs or profits. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
This is command central for the healthcare reform law, the main headquarters of the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington. The place is humming. Workers greet each other apologetically, saying, I've just been so busy.
That's why I haven't called you.
Well, when you get some free time.
Yes, I will.
Free time is in short supply around here, so is workspace. Staffers assigned to the medical loss ratio rule got rid of the microwave and fridge in their break room so they'd have more room to work. The team members are so stretched they delegated a big chunk of the job to an outsider, Sandy Prager.
Well, I start my day with a couple of stiff cups of coffee so I can stay awake through all of this.
Prager is the state insurance commissioner of Kansas. She heads a panel of state commissioners advising the federal government on the medical loss ratio rule. The rule will specify which expenses insurance companies can count as care. The commissioners will write the rule and submit it to the department for final approval. Everybody wants Prager's ear. Insurance companies, consumer advocates.
Responding to all the questions and all of the issues is kind of like drinking water out of a fire hose. It's coming at us fast and furious.
The intent of the rule is to make sure most of the money paid for health insurance is spent on health care. Not advertising, not salespeople, not CEO salaries, not profits. The rule requires insurers to spend at least 80% of the premiums they collect on care. The biggest question, what exactly qualifies as a health care expense? Insurers and their lobbyists want as broad an interpretation as possible. Consumer advocates are on the other side. Both sides were in Seattle last month for a meeting of the insurance commissioners. The pro-reform group Healthcare for America Now was handing out lobbyist disinfection kits, hand sanitizer and deodorant soap.
Disinfect yourselves and not inoculate yourselves from these lobbyist lies.
Last week, activists and insurers got an idea of what the new rules might look like when a committee of commissioners released a draft rule. The rule allows insurers to deduct certain taxes, making it easier to meet the ratio. But under the proposal, insurers can't count things like fighting fraud as a health care expense. Marketing doesn't count either. So it might be harder for insurers to count brochures that promote wellness, for instance, as care. Robert Zirkelbach is a spokesman for the insurance trade group America's Health Insurance Plans. He says some materials should be counted as care.
So if you understand that it's helping patients, giving them information they need to take care of their particular health condition, you can see very clearly it's exactly the types of programs and services that people agree we need to be doing more of in our healthcare system.
Consumer advocate and former insurance industry executive Wendell Potter disagrees. He says health insurers are trying to put as much in the care column as possible to free more money for salaries and profits.
A lot of money that we spend in our premiums goes into the pockets of well-paid executives. If congressional intent is carried out, this will make these companies behave differently and spend our premium dollars differently.
The version released last week is just a draft. All the insurance commissioners still have to approve it. They plan to consider it at a national meeting next month. Until then, the battle between lobbyists and consumer advocates will continue. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I think we need to repay society. China still has more than 40 million people who aren't able to eat three meals a day.
The challenge of charity in China. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials rose 46 points today, 0.4%, closed at 10,858. The NASDAQ bumped up 9 points, also 0.4%, ended things at 2379. The S&P 500 gained 5 points, about 0.5%. Finished at 1147. Financial shares were mixed today. Morgan Stanley off nearly 1.5%. Goldman Sachs fell 0.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase forfeited about 0.3%. Walgreens pleased investors with better-than-expected quarterly profits. Stock in the drugstore chain leaped more than 11.5% today. Rival CVS Caremark picked up 2.75%. Endo Pharmaceuticals poured on just over 8% on news that it's going to buy out a rival. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note slipped to 2.47%. Keep an eye on that one, folks. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Nixon Peabody LLP, a full-service international law firm offering practical solutions for today's real-world business challenges. More at nixonpeabody.com. Coverage of the economy is supported in part by the Schuman Center for Media and Democracy. And by PBS, presenting baseball the 10th inning from Ken Burns, tonight at 8, 7 Central on most PBS stations. Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Wednesday. President Obama is scheduled to talk with families about the economy in Des Moines, Iowa. The 5th Annual Obesity and Wellness Congress continues in Washington. The focus is on ways behavioral economics can combat obesity. And it was a day that hit some pocketbooks pretty hard. On September 29, 2008, the Dow suffered its biggest one-day point loss in history, closing down almost 778 points. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Yes, the music means just one thing, that it's your turn. A lot has been said since congressional Republicans released their pledge to America last week. We chimed in as well, and your responses were favorable and less so. David Rigby from Winston-Salem, North Carolina, didn't much care for how we framed our story.
An interesting title to your story. Will a pledge change anything? Of course not. Only action changes things. We are overdue for fiscally responsible action.
A lot of you took action when you heard Gustavo Arellano's commentary a couple of weeks ago about how we've all become a little bit Mexican in the recession as we embrace frugality and do-it-yourself solutions like raising chickens and growing our own vegetables. Some of you hated the commentary, others loved it. Amanda Cundiff from Vallejo, California, was on the fence. Funny, she said, but not quite true, or at least the part about the chickens being cheap.
Keeping hens can be expensive. To do it correctly, you need a safe, secure, sanitary coop. I've heard friends say that after building a really nice coop, buying organic feed, and then raising chicks to point of lay, their first egg is worth $500. On top of that, my chickens aren't even laying at all right now. They're on strike while they molt.
We do it all here, eggs to vegetables. I interviewed Tracy Carson from Mason, Ohio last week about the school district's decision to put baby carrots in vending machines at the high school. Nick Patton from Hudson, New York, is no fan of carrots or any food, really, that comes out of a machine.
I will agree that it beats Fritos, but are we so far gone that we have no other way to provide snacks for kids in school than vending machines? I know you can do the math, but at the age of 57, I'm happy to tell you that I survived grade school and high school with no vending machines at either one. Imagine that.
One more food story before we move on. There's a chef out here in Los Angeles who started up a restaurant that relies on homegrown produce from its neighbors for its menu. People thought the idea and the story were both pretty cool, but this remark by the restaurateur about potential vendors.
Some old lady with the bag of lemons coming in and being like, you know, give me money for these lemons.
That rankled Nancy McCarthy from Roslindale, Massachusetts.
Some old lady? Why is it okay to speak condescendingly about a person based on gender and age? Let's hope the hip urban farmers were young and male.
Fair enough. Finally, a correction about something else that comes out of the ground. Bob Moon interviewed Scott Tong while I was away last week about the booming Chinese trade in rare earth metals. Not only are they rare, but they are hard to pronounce, so of course we messed it up.
Dysprosium.
Scientists among you, and really, who knew there were so many of you out there, you wrote to point out that we spelled it wrong on our website, too, so here you go. It's properly pronounced dysprosium, D-Y-S-P-R-O-S-I-U-M. I was my eighth grade spelling champion, by the way. If you'd like to correct us or just tell us how much you like us, drop us a line at our website, marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. Warren Buffett and Bill Gates have never been the types to just sit back and count their billions. Gates has his foundation, Buffett has his company, Berkshire Hathaway, and they have something they're working on together. They're trying to convince other members of the economic stratosphere to give a big chunk of their money to charity. Buffett and Gates are in Beijing this week, where they've invited 50 of China's wealthiest people to dinner tomorrow. Might turn out to be a more intimate affair than they'd expected. Hardly anybody responded. Chinese press reports that only two people bothered to RSVP at all. Are they being stingy, or is there something else going on here? Marketplace of China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
Chen Guangbiao's worth nearly $1 billion. He's saved the date for the Gates-Buffett banquet. But if his fellow invitees are no-shows, here's his plan.
If they refuse to go, I'll leak each of their names to the media. They have no excuse not to come to this dinner.
Chen made his fortune from his recycling business. He's been a businessman as long as he can remember. In third grade, he hiked miles to the nearest village to sell well water, all you can drink for half a penny. It sounds like a cute young entrepreneur story until he tells you why he did it. His older brother and sister had just starved to death. If he didn't do something, he'd be next.
In fourth grade, I sold popsicles. In fifth grade, I sold vegetables in the market. In junior high school, I had enough to buy a film projector, so I played movies for farmers.
Chen never stopped selling, and that's why he's worth so much at the tender age of 42. Many among China's 117 billionaires have similar stories, so Chen almost flies off his seat when asked about the lack of response to Gates and Buffett's call to philanthropy.
This makes me so mad. How did we get so rich? We've had favorable economic policies, and China's working class helped us get there. I think we need to repay society. China still has more than 40 million people who aren't able to eat three meals a day.
Chen thinks his wealthy counterparts just don't get it. They've only been rich a short time, he says, and they want to hang on to what they've got. But there are other, more complicated reasons, starting with how the Gates Foundation publicized the dinner. In fact, publicizing it in the Chinese press was the problem.
If I were advising them myself, I think I would have started on a much smaller scale.
Russell Flannery compiles the Forbes China Rich List. He says it's not that China's wealthiest don't want to give. Many are already doing so. He says those invited to the dinner tell him they feel anxious about such a public invitation. They would have preferred a more private affair with fewer people invited. Being rich in China isn't something you advertise. That's because how you got there is oftentimes a little dodgy.
You were doing something wrong at that time. You became rich from it. And now society doesn't tolerate that, or it might be considered to be illegal. A fair number of people in China that are successful built up their resources and their capital in that kind of an environment.
That's why the Forbes Rich List in China is dubbed the Death List. Dozens who've appeared on it have been imprisoned or investigated for corruption. Another problem is the lack of philanthropic infrastructure. China gives no tax breaks for charity, and charitable foundations are shackled by Beijing, which prefers people see it as the only charity in town. None of this is stopping Chen Guangbiao, though. Chen attends an event at the World's Fair in Shanghai. He's being celebrated for his pledge to donate his entire fortune to charity when he dies. He says a meeting with Bill Gates last year and then this dinner invitation convinced him it was the right thing to do. Chinese bloggers criticized the decision, saying he should give more money to his family. Audience member Ding Lifang is a little skeptical, too.
How do we know if he'll actually go through with it? But if he doesn't, we shouldn't criticize him. You become wealthy through hard work. It's his money, and he can do what he wants with it.
Bill Gates and Warren Buffett are sure to be pleased by Chen's generosity. Now, if they could just convince China's other billionaires, they might be able to avoid twiddling their thumbs in an empty banquet hall in Beijing. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, working to reduce traffic and pollution while moving 1 million tons of freight daily. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, quite probably the first time the gossipy website Gawker.com has graced this program. Not that I read it or anything. But they have done what could properly be called a public service. They rated the celebrity tabloid magazines on how accurate they are. We'll repeat it here just so you have some perspective the next time you're in the supermarket checkout line. Us Weekly is the winner. Almost 60% of what they print actually turns out to be true. The other 40%, I guess, is just fun to read. I don't know. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rose 46 points, about 0.4%. The NASDAQ bumped up 9 points, also 0.4%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. That's 0.5%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Rod Abid on our Marketplace Morning Report. And that's where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time on this show, budget gimmicks only get you so far, you know.
Right now, the bill would raise $500 million, but it's one time.
Virginia tries anything to balance the books. I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.